to the left. You know, I want to welcome everybody here, and I want to thank Jose for asking me here tonight. As it was said before, it's an honor and a privilege to be a part of it. I know it's an honor to serve in any way. Right up here, people just tell me parts of my story to tell. A lot of people know my story better than I do, I think. But you know, I gotta break this down. You know, the aloha, the luau, and watching the dancers, and just gave me a warm feeling inside, like I wish I'd never left Hawaii. But at any rate, aloha, everybody knows it means love, it means hello, it means a lot of things. But if you go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in Hawaii, it means a lot of happy alcoholics. And, you know, I'm not your typical speaker. And as you can tell, I'm kind of nervous up here. But hopefully I'll get over that. You know, these rooms saved my life. And I've been in and out of these rooms since I was 20 years old. I grew up in a family of alcoholics, and I swore I'd never drink. And I can remember screaming at my parents and telling them I'll never drink because I never want to raise my kids the way you raised us. And you know, that's the way it was. I didn't drink as a kid. I was very shy, very much an introvert, had an inferiority complex, and maybe I should have drank. But you know, back when I was growing up, they had the draft. And I got a draft notice right out of high school. And I said, I just got away from my parents. I don't want to go where they're going to tell me what to do, so I tore it up. And so a month later, I got another draft notice. And I tore it up. And so then I got a third one, and they told me, if you don't respond to this one, they'll come and put you in jail. So I grabbed my buddy and we went and joined the Navy. And 2 weeks before Christmas, I was in boot camp. And, during boot camp, everybody talked about what they was going to do when they get out. And everybody said they're going to get drunk and they're going to get laid. Well, you know, I got on that airplane after boot camp going home for 2 weeks leave before my next duty station. And the airline stewardess came up to me and she said, what would I like to have to drink? And I said, I'm that naive little kid is still scared. And I said, I'm not old enough to drink. And she said, son, there's a war going on. You're in uniform and we're up here in the air and you can have anything you want. And I didn't know what to order. In TV and the movies, they drink martinis. So I said, give me a martini. And you know, I hated that damn thing. But you're allowed to. I said, give me one more. And so that was the beginning of my drinking right there. She was from Indiana. That's where I'm from. And every time she walked by me, she made sure my glass was full. And needless to say, when we started to land at O'Hare Field in Chicago, I'm reaching for that air sick bag. Well, in the meantime, that scared little boy that scared to ask a girl to go to the junior or senior prom, after he had a couple of drinks, had those airline shoulders sitting on my lap. They were taking pictures. So that scared little boy wasn't so scared anymore. And when I started to get sick, they took me to the back of the plane to clean me off. And they took turns sitting by me and holding the cold towel on me. And that was my beginning. But you know, my buddies carried me off the plane. They said, sit down here, we'll go get your seat back, don't move. So I'm sitting there and there's this lady who comes up to me. And she says, son, were you just on such and such a flight? And I said, yeah. She said, you know, I'm on business flights all the time. And they're boring as hell, but she said, this is the best flight I've ever been on. And you know, about 5 minutes later, there was a guy who came up and said the very same thing. They said, son, you got the makings of the finest sailor. And you know, I wanted to be drunk all the time after that. And you know, I pretty much was. I got in so much trouble in the Navy You know, I got transferred to Marcus Point, Pearl Harbor, and they put me doing mess duty for 5 months. And I hated it. You know, everybody there was just loafing around. I wanted to go drink. And I got in trouble because everybody was taking too much time. So finally, I got in so much trouble that they called me into the office and said that if I would straighten up for a week, they put me on night shift. And they said, night shift is important to start with liberty. I mean, we're 3 days 1 week and 4 days the next. I thought, that's a pretty good deal. I got in trouble, but they still put me on the night shift. And the reason I tell that story is because a true alcoholic finds a way. And every time I worked there, I mean, every time we went to work, the chief there, he would disappear as soon as we got there. And I thought, I'm going to follow him and see what's going on. And he'd tell us what to do, and he'd go back there, and he brought beer with him every night. He'd sit back there all night drinking beer. And because I caught him, he said, I'm going to put you in charge of the rest of the guys, and you can come back there and drink with me. And that's what I did. Okay, you know, to get on with my story, you know, I did so much drinking, I got in trouble, I got transferred to a ship. I'm going to tell, you know, there was an incident in the Navy where I almost got killed. The guy who slept next to me did get killed. They slit his belly, and we had him marked AOL for 3 days. And just like in the old movies, you know, our ship was pulling out, and you see all these cars rushing to the end of the pier, and they got on the bullhorn and told us to come back, that they thought they found one of our sailors. And it was the guy who slept next to me. So, you know, the next night that we're in port was our last trip there. It was in the Philippines to pick up supplies. So we decided we decided we're going to go to get our checks changed over into pesos, and we were going to take a tour to Manila the next day. And then, you know, I have advice with women, too. We got our checks changed over, and we're walking down the street coming back. We're getting ready to come back to the ship. And as we're walking back, this lady just picked me up and carried me inside. Well, I didn't argue with her. And so when I came back to the rock on my ship, I'm by myself. And this jeepney kind of, I got in there, just me and the driver, and then two other guys jumped in. And he started to take a shortcut, and I said, no, go the regular main road. And he didn't listen to me. I put up such a stink that, anyway, the guys behind me, the guy put his arm around my neck, put a knife up to my throat, and they told the driver to reach over and get my wallet. Well, natural instinct, I kicked him in the head. But then I felt that knife up against my throat, and I froze. I went into shock because I remembered what happened to that guy who sleeps next to me, and they found him dead. So I just, you know, I was dead too. You know, but you know, they didn't kill me. And that was just that experience. But you know, I had so many things that happened to me. And the moral of the story is, if I would have listened to you people when I first got into these rooms, a lot of the hard things that happened to me would have never happened. You know, I can't count the number of times that I've been close to death. My first time in these rooms was when I was 20 years old. And I was over the hill, as a matter of fact. In San Bernardino, I didn't think the Navy was treating me right. So I thought it'd be better to go live with the winos than it would be to do what I was doing. And so they told me I better turn myself in or I'm going to get concerned. I would be considered a deserter. And I thought, I didn't get two campaigns in Vietnam. I certainly don't want to be considered a deserter. So I turned myself in, and while I was in that jail cell, I started going through the DTs. And they took me to the hospital there in San Bernardino, and at any rate, I can remember they gave me 3 shots and some paraldehyde, and they told me they had an armed guard. And this nurse told the armed guard, before we get him, you don't need to be here. He said, but I do have to be here. Well, you know, I woke up hallucinating, going through the DTs again. And whatever they did wasn't enough. And so the next time I woke up, they had me on a gurney and put me in an ambulance and took me to the Long Beach Naval Hospital, where they had me in a glass room tied to a bed, going through the DTs. And I was trembling so bad that that's why they had me in the glass room, because if any of those tubes came out of me, I might have bled to death. And see, that was at the ripe old age of 20. And a guy came to me and said that we had just started a treatment facility in Long Beach, if I wanted to come to it. And I said, I don't know. And he said, if you don't, you're probably going to jail. And he said, I'll give you till tomorrow to make up your mind. Well, I didn't want to go to jail, but at any rate, the next day I said, yes, I'll go. And you know, I went there, and I'm going through this program. You know, it was so long ago, I got to actually see Chuck Chamberlain speak 3 different times. I saw her Clancy speak when he was 10 years sober. I went to so many different, seen so many Chop Tops and all these different films. All the knowledge in the world wouldn't keep me sober. You know, it wasn't until I got into the program and started doing some action. You know, I love these rooms. I love Alcoholics Anonymous today. But you know, I have to do everything the hard way, it seems. I got into these rooms when I was 20, and I got caught drinking, and they put me on Anabuse, and I drank on Anabuse. And I know why they did you an EKG before they give it to you, because when I drank on it, I didn't even you know, you take it, it's just like taking aspirin, you don't remember taking it 10 minutes later. And we stole some Liberty Guard cards and went to downtown, and I split up from them, and I went to a bar and had a beer. The guy looks at me, and I ordered another beer, and he said, are you okay? I said, what? He said, your face is getting red. I said, it's just hot in here. So I said, give me another beer. So he gave me that second beer, and he looked at me again, and he said, are you sure you're okay? I said, yeah, give me another beer. He said, your face is as red as that light bulb up there. I said, so he gave me that third beer, and I just tried a couple of drinks out of it. And it was one of those old bars, real long bars, and you got to walk a long ways to get to the bathroom. And I'm walking back there, and I think my heart's coming out of my chest, and I'm holding onto my chest. And as we get closer, and as I keep walking, then I've got both hands over my heart, because I just know it's coming out of my chest. That's a true story. I just know exactly what I thought was happening. And you know, that should have told me I was an alcoholic right there, but 3 weeks later, a guy from there told me, says, why don't we go to North Hollywood? They got that place where we can drink, blah, blah, blah. And I said, did you end up in the hospital? And he says, yeah, but he says, if we just sip our drinks, we'll become immune to it. Well, that didn't work. So, you know, I straightened up. I went to AA. I found this couple who took me to meetings all over Long Beach, and they introduced me to this other guy who took me to meetings in North Hollywood where I heard speakers like Bobby Earl and Serenity Sam and other people. And you know, I didn't drink until I got out. I went and told the chief. I said, you know, you got to take me off this Anabuse. I said, how are we going to know if this program's working if you don't? That's just a crutch. And he did take me off of it, and I didn't drink at that time, and not until I got out of the service. And you know, when I got home on leave, I got home after I was discharged from there. And I think the only reason I got an honorable discharge was because I was going through that treatment program. And I'm sure thankful that I did. I got home. I ended up in jail 3 times in 2 weeks just for public intoxication. Back in Indiana, the bars don't open on Sundays at that time, and they didn't, you know, they'd pick you up for anything. I got put in jail twice, and the second time the judge looked at me and says, "Weren't you just here?" And I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "If I see you again in 6 months, you're going to do 6 months on the state farm," which is the prison in Indiana. And so that same weekend, I'm back in jail again. It's a holiday weekend, and everybody in there is laughing at me because I'm going to go to prison. And I didn't think that was funny at all, you know. And so it just so happened I got to the jail, to the courthouse, and that judge wasn't fair, it was a different judge. And he said, "I don't have any paperwork on you. Have you ever been here before?" I said, "No, sir, Your Honor." So I skated again. But you see, I moved right from there to another town, 40 miles away, and drinking with my uncle. And when I woke up, all I seen was bars. And now that's a scary feeling, because I've been there by myself. I have no idea why I'm in jail. I've been a blackout when I went in. And when I woke up, all I seen was those bars, and nobody could tell me why I'm there, what happened. Did I kill anybody? What the hell happened? And I didn't have a clue. And I'm stuck there until finally my aunt came and bailed me out. And she told me about a veteran's, a VA program they had in Marion, Indiana. And they just started a program for alcoholics and drug addicts. She said if I went there, it would probably look better when I seen the judge. So I went off to there, and this was my first real trip to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm in that treatment program there. I almost got thrown out after 2 weeks, but I stuck it out, and then I went into a halfway house in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and I got involved in AA, and you know, the rest is history. Everything was fine as long as I was doing what I was supposed to be doing. You know, and that's important for me today, to keep doing what I'm supposed to be doing. Because I got into Alcoholics Anonymous up there. I got two sponsors. I got an older person as a sponsor. And I'm 23 years old, so I got a younger person as a sponsor. And you know, I went to these meetings every day. I went to a young people's meeting once a week. And every day they're telling me, what step did you do? What did you do? Anyways, they're always having fun and joking and cutting up like we do here today. And I didn't feel like that. I'm still that shy little boy in high school without that drinking side of me. And each week I'd tell them what step I did. And I finished all my steps, and when it was my turn to share, I told them, I said, "How come I don't feel like you guys? How come I'm not happy? How come I'm not laughing, having a good time like you guys?" And the guy who was my sponsor was at the other end of the table, and he got a piece of paper and he wrote something down. And then he passed it around, and it got to me. And I looked at it and said, "Yes." And I said, "What the hell is his problem?" And they said, "Open it up." I opened it up and I said, "Keep it simple, stupid." And you know, at that time, it didn't mean a lot to me, but today it does. And you know, everything was going fine. I had a lot of commitments. I was doing service work. I went to a lot of meetings. And then, lo and behold, I met a woman who wasn't inappropriate. And she told me, "What makes a difference whether you're sober or not? You're never home." So one by one, I quit doing the things that was keeping me sober. And that was my downfall. And so, you know, when I did my inventory, when I got sober this time, that's definitely what I had to realize first and foremost, that my sobriety has to be number one in my life. Because if I'm not sober, I don't have a life. But you know, at any rate, like I said, I quit doing those things, and the next thing you know, I'm drinking again because things didn't work out with us. And you know, I thought it was the end of the world when it didn't work out for us. And so I didn't want my friends who had been in AA for 2.5 years in to see me, so I waited till I drove across the state line before I drank. I found a bar next to a motel, so I wouldn't have to drive. And after a couple of drinks, that bar wasn't good enough. I said, where's this another place to go? And I said, up there. So I drove up to the mountains. Up there, they're trying to kill each other. I said, this ain't my kind of place either. So I'm coming back down the mountains, and the very first time I got drunk after leaving Alcoholics Anonymous, I drove my car up to the Ozark Mountains. A tree trunk stopped me from going all the way down. And you know what? I was more worried about drunk driving than I was thinking that I just almost died. And I got back, but that didn't stop me. 11 months later, I'm in the Portland Veterans Hospital, and they thought I was jaundiced. And they took a piece of my liver out and did a liver biopsy on me. And then I'm off to another treatment facility at American Lake in Washington. And then another halfway house. I was sober in Hawaii, in Seattle for a year and a half. And I'm telling you all of this because, you see, when I drank again, it did get worse. And every day, every time we go to a meeting anywhere, we hear people say that. But for me, I used to always think, if that happened to me, I'd quit too. But you see, I never thought it would ever happen to me. But you see, worse things happen to me. You know, I've had hundreds of jobs in my life, from good jobs and bad jobs, bad jobs just to get by on. I worked, you know, I was a runner. Whenever I drank, I ran. And whenever I ran, the bottle always went with me, too. When I was, like I said, I ended up back in Seattle, and I was sober there, and when things didn't work out there, I ended up back in California. And I finally turned, you know, I've lived and worked in odd jobs with Manpower and different temporary employment agencies all over the world, I mean, all over the country, from Florida to California. And I've lived in parks, I've been homeless. And like I said, I've had decent jobs. I did find one job where I could drink and party and still make a living and still travel. And that's what people wanted me to tell you. That's where I found a job where I could work with the carnivals, giving away teddy bears for love affairs. And you know what? I was reading the 24-hour book or one of these books today or yesterday and was talking, or no, I was listening to a CD. I think it was Clarence Snyder. But anyways, he was talking about how alcoholics excel. They're good at something. Well, I excelled at the carnival. I made pretty damn good money with them. And no matter how drunk I got, but I even lost a couple of jobs with them because of my drinking. But you see, no matter what was going on in my life, I was always drunk. Without that drink, I was lost. Unless I was in a program, unless I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to tell you, I've been in these rooms, I've been in halfway houses, in different places, just to get me off the street, because of one reason or another. But you know, whenever I came into these rooms, and I came in here with the intention because I wanted to be here, and I would work a program, my life always got better. Like I said, there's been times when I put somebody or something in front of my sobriety and it didn't go right. You know, when I got sober this time, I was in San Francisco, and I found an ableist there, And that worked out. I did get a job. I'm working in a decent hotel there. And I would come home about 11 o'clock at night. I'd get off work, and I'd always stop at this one bar. And this lady didn't know me, but she seen me stop there all the time. And she said, "You know, I don't know any of these people in here. Would I stay there until somebody came in that she knew?" I told her, "I don't have the money to stay here." She said, "I'll buy your drinks till somebody comes in." That was my first enablement. And you know, from then I just blossomed. I thought I had it made because, you know, anytime I could go in there and she would give me free drinks all day long, the other bartenders started giving me free drinks. And, you know, the owners, owner one time told them to quit giving me the free drinks, so he was killing me. I said, "Don't listen to him." And you know, but he was right, it was killing me. But you know, those enablers, that lady who I was telling you about, she was 35 years old when she died of this disease. When she found out I was homeless and didn't have a place to go, she called her husband and said that I was going to be sleeping on their couch. She gave me the keys to her place. You know, another lady, I was a stripper there, and she became a bartender. People used to go out of the way to do things for her because that's how gorgeous she was. And she was one sexy lady. She died of this disease, and she was younger than the other one. And she was one of my enablers. She used to grab me off the bar stool and take me down to the Hofbräu and say, "You got to eat something." But she also bought me a shot of Yukon Jack while she was there. And you know, that's just the way my life was. I could go in there and drink all day. I go home, I come back at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, knock on the door, they let me in. I could do that at 2 or 3 different bars there in San Francisco. And you know why it didn't kill me? I don't know. I really don't. I'm just blessed. Those people I just mentioned never made it to these rooms. There's a lady who used to come into that same bar and see me sitting on that bar stool every day. And she drank too. But every now and then she disappeared. And she'd come in and said, "I haven't drank for X amount of days and I feel great." She said, "I should do that too." And I said, "I'm not ready." And she'd come back again. She said, "I've been sober for 23 days. Then I should try it. It's great." I said, "I'm not ready." And you know, when I got sober this time, I was sober for about a year and a half. And I always went to this meeting up in Knob Hill because I had the same kind of fear when I got sober this time as I did when I was back in high school, until I started doing the program and things started changing. And I made myself go to this meeting up there where there's over 500 people every Tuesday night just to try and overcome my fear. And you know, somehow out of all those people, she found me and she came up, throwed her arms around me and gave me a hug and said, "I've got 10 days." And you know, 2 weeks later, she started drinking again. And 2 weeks later, she walked out of the bar and somebody shot her and she's dead. So when they say to stick around, you don't know what's going to happen when you go back out there. And it's for sure, I don't. And that's why, you know, I take my program so seriously. There's no room for me out there. Why I'm still here, I have no idea. I'm just grateful that I am. You know, another thing that happened, you know, like I said, I worked in carnivals in different parts of the country. I could always get a job because if I mentioned whoever I worked for, they put me to work. It was never a problem for me because it was something I knew how to do. And so anyways, in between, you know, it's winter time, there's no carnivals going on. I'm working in a hotel in San Francisco, and this big Indian that I was working the carnival with that year came by. and his new girlfriend, or whoever she was, said, come to Monterey with us. I said, what's there for me? So you can stay and watch our little girl while we work or whatever. And my mind's just thinking party. I'm not thinking about anything else, because all we did with the carnival was party. So I take off and go with them, and we get to Monterey, and they break up, so me and him ends up living in his sister's basement, or not basement, in the garage. His brother was already had a bed set up in there. So we had three beds set up in this garage. And we're there, I don't know what he has a decent job in Carmel Valley. And anyways, we're going to have a big party. And this guy who just got out of prison in New York was there. And he was going to be a part of that party too. So he had me drive him over to Safeway store. And I drove him over there, and he went and got a grocery cart and filled it up with half gallons and quarts and whatever kinds of booze he could fit in that cart. And he just pushed it out to the car. He forgot to pay for it. And I'm looking around, and nobody's following us. He said, drive over there to Long's Drugstore. This is in Monterey. So I drove over there, and he got another shopping cart full of the booze, just like I said. And just pushed it out of the car. Still forgot to pay. Nobody came after us. So we got home, and that night we was going to have a party. And I don't know where we was, but we stopped for a drink, and these gals was in there. And I asked them if they wanted to come to the party. No, but this one did. So she came to the party with me, and we were there during the night, and all these people, local people, were there that I didn't know that lived there at Monterey. So, I mean, we're there. So the next morning, about 10 o'clock in the morning, I think. Anyways, these local boys came over to me and said, he's going to rape this girl I picked up. I said, no, you're not. So one of them just reached over and grabbed a lead pipe and swung into my head. Well, naturally, I put my hand up there. And when I hit my finger, I moved my hand away. And so that's all I remember until I woke up about 7 o'clock that night. I had to pee. I woke up on a mattress in a pool of blood. And I tried to walk to the bathroom. To the door. I was going to pee out the door. And I couldn't walk. I had to hobble on one leg. And the bones above my ankle were just shattered. Crushed where they hit me, I guess. I don't know. But I had pus, coming out of my head for 2.5 years after that. They told me, you're not going to no doctor because I was afraid I'd get him in trouble. And 3 days later, I finally did go to a doctor. But this one guy who had just gotten out of prison thought I was dead. And so his idea was to cut me up into little pieces and put me in a plastic bag and drop me off the Monterey Pier. And this big Indian, his sister seen me flinch or move or something. So they said he's still alive. That's why they drug me back inside the garage. See, booze did all of this to me. If I followed the booze, it didn't matter where it was or what was going on. I drank. I didn't have to have a birthday or a holiday, a payday. I drank every day. I got drunk every day for many, many years. And that's why it's a wonder that I'm still here. The only time I ever really had a life was when I was in these rooms and trying to work a program. That's why I have so much gratitude for these rooms. When I got sober this time, I'm in a hotel room where I'm living, and I wanted to quit drinking a couple of times, but just couldn't. And so I hadn't been to the bar the day before, and this was sometime in the afternoon the next day, I don't know when. I had to hold on to things to get to the bathroom. And I looked in that mirror, and I just looked like death warmed over My eyes was grayish, and my eyes was in the back of my head, and my face was grayish. And I can remember saying out loud, I said, God, this is how I'm going to die too. Because I'm thinking of my enablers who died before they even got here. So I just got on my knees and I asked God for help. You know, I didn't do anything else. I just got back in my bed after a prayer. And I don't know how much time transpired, but I do know that the phone rang sometime after that. It was the guy who owns the bar. And he said, get yourself together. I'm taking you to the hospital. I don't want you to die like our friends. And that's how I got here. And then, you know, God intervened again. Because, like I said, I didn't call anybody. I just prayed. He called me. But then he didn't show up, and I'm sick. I didn't realize I was going through the DTs, but I was. And I needed a drink. And I walked to the door to go get a drink. And I thought, well, I'll go back and I'll call him first and see. And he got busy at the bar. He couldn't leave. He said, I'll be right there. So I waited for him to come, and that's how I got here. And you know, I was in that same hospital 5 times for alcoholism over the years, but twice in that same year. I was there in January, and then I was back there again this time in September. I got sober in September of 1993. And, you know, I'm in the hospital, and I go through their program, and the lady there who was running the program had tried her best to talk me into going to outpatient when I was there in January, and to go to a halfway house and to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I turned her down on everything. She tried her best to talk me into it. I said, no. I said, I don't need any of that. All I need is Alcoholics Anonymous, because I know Alcoholics Anonymous works. But you see, when it was time for me to walk out of that hospital in January, I'm thinking to myself, well, I don't know anybody in AA, so I'll just go back to the bar and just drink juice. Well, that didn't work. That's why I was back there in September. And you know, one more story about that happened while I was still drinking. You know, I'd always had it in the back of my mind that Alcoholics Anonymous was good and that it worked. And I'm sitting there in my seat. And you know, these two guys are coming in, and it's morning, and they're down, they're talking bad about Alcoholics Anonymous, saying all these kinds of things about it. And I looked at them and I said, what's your problem? I said, there's nothing wrong with AA. It works if you want it to. And they're looking at me with my bourbon and water. And the bartender's walking towards me and laughing and said, yeah, what's your problem? I said, I'm not ready yet. But you see, I was talking good about AA while I was still in my disease back then. But you know, make a long story short, you know, I did go to the outpatient program in September. And I did go to an outpatient program after I got out. And you know, I can remember telling myself, you know, I've never fulfilled a commitment ever. I'm going to fulfill this one. It's a 6-month deal. I'm going to go through with it. And 2 months away from there, they decide they're going to put me in a different house with all new faces and new people. And I said, I can't do that. I said, I have so much fear just getting used to the people I'm with here. I can't go through it again. I said, I'm not going to move. They said, you don't have a choice. And I was mad. And I didn't want to go through that fear again, trying to get to know more people. So I had exactly $2 for my name and a candy bar and a pack of cigarettes. And I just decided I'm leaving. I told the guys in there I was leaving. They said the next week I was leaving. Well, you know, I'm going to my outpatient program like I'm supposed to. And I could walk through Golden Gate Park, or I could take the bus. It was kind of raining that day, but I decided to walk anyway because I was scared. I didn't want to drink, and I needed to talk to God because I didn't know what to do. I didn't want to move, and I didn't want to drink, and I'm in this dilemma. And I'm walking through the Golden Gate Park, and I'm talking to God. And I said, I'm willing. I said, I think I'm willing. I said, well, I'm willing to be willing. And all my mind's just going crazy. But God knew I was sincere in that. So when I'm going through there and I get towards the other side, I could see some sunlight coming through the trees. But when I got past those trees, I looked up and I seen a rainbow. I just got a warm feeling inside, like it's going to be okay. And you know what happened? I can never explain it. I express that feeling that I got when I seen that rainbow. There's no words for it. But it was just a warm feeling like it's okay. And you know, it has. And not all things is a bed of roses. You know, I had a bad experience. When I got sober, I'm too proud to ask you guys for a cigarette. I'm going around the streets picking up cigarette butts off the street. Not because I wanted to, but I guess it's been pride. But you know, I finally somehow got a settlement from the government. I don't know, it was about a year and a half sober or something. And so I'm going to go on a trip. And in the meantime, let me back up for a minute. When I did walk out of that halfway house, just like I said I was going to, a week later, and I got on that train going downtown, not knowing where I'm going. I gave up my room at this hotel 3 weeks before that, and I'm gripping the bars on the seat in front of me, and I'm talking to God, and I'm saying, you know, God, I don't know what to do. I said, if I'm homeless, the only way I know how to survive is to drink, and I don't want to drink. And I stayed on somebody's floor that night, and the next day, I started staying in out-of-order rooms at the hotel. The same one that they fired me 9 times in 4 years from. And so I'm staying there, and the guy got me my job back 1 day a week. No, I got no money, but at least I had a room to sleep in. And so that's where I'm staying when I got this settlement. And he told me, he says, put your money in the safe deposit box, sir. Nobody can touch it but me, the owner, or yourself. He said, that way when I come back from my trip, I won't be broke. So off to, guess where I went? Hawaii. And I went on my trip, and when I came back, that box was empty. And I was mad, but only for an instant, because I was hurt. The only person I ever trusted was that guy, because he kept me from being homeless. And that money, that $2,500, was gone. And for a guy who had absolutely nothing when I got here, that hurt. And you know, I can't explain it. Like I said, God was with me. I got up to my room. I did a little inventory. And there's nothing I can do about it. It's already done. And so, and I prayed about it. And so then I went to an AA meeting. And after the meeting was over, I went over to this guy and I said, will you go have coffee with me? And he said, yes. You see, I learned this from being in these rooms, from having an open mind and listening to you people. And so there's no answer for what happened, but just by talking to it, it kind of uses the power it has over my mind. It helps me get through these things. And you know, that's one thing I learned from getting into these rooms. They always talked about honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness when I first got sober. And I honestly hated my life. And I figured if anybody can look at their life honestly, and if they don't like what they see, then they should come here and have an open mind and listen to what other people are doing. And, you know, I'm so grateful. You know, I remember that second sponsor I told you about that I had back in Indiana, he always said, I never saw a grateful alcoholic get drunk. And you know, if I'm honest with myself, and if I'm having a bad day or things ain't going right, and if I'm mad at the world, whatever's going on up here, I can just quit long enough to remember where I was and where I'm at today. I have no reason not to be grateful. You know, these rooms have saved my life. in more ways than one. I don't know where I was going here. But you know, one of the other things I can tell you is when I first come into these rooms, I sat around tables, and I'd be discussion rooms, and we were all new, and or most of us were new, and everybody's talking about if I had a job, if I had a girlfriend, or if I had a car, if I had this. They all wanted something. Myself, I was just happy to be there. I can't explain it. I was just happy to have another chance. And you know, each week, we'd be going to, I'd go to those meetings, and one by one, those people would be gone. But I was still there. And you know, it's not that I didn't want the things that they did. Sure, I would like to have a lot of things, you know. But I knew that I had to be sober first. I practiced, you know, everybody would get mad at me for saying this when I was new, but I prayed for patience and acceptance. And they said, I pray for patience. Don't you want this much? Sure I did. But I knew I had to accept things for what they are now. And the things would happen. Things would come. And you know, like I said, there was things that, and disappointments, because I didn't get things that I wanted at different times. But you know what helped me along too was that even though I didn't get what I wanted at different times, you know, I stayed sober. I got through that. And a few months down the road, I would get something that was much better. Much better than I wanted to begin with. And I would not have got that if I had gotten my way. And for me, it just showed me that God had a better idea of what was good for me than I did. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me so much. That meeting with those 500 people, I told you I was still full of fear, and I was trying to overcome my fear by going up to that meeting all the time. Well, I learned something up there. I learned that those women up there want a man just as much as a man wants a woman, because they used to flash and do all kinds of stuff. And God was with me again, because I was too scared to talk to him, because that's where I got in trouble before, with getting involved with women too soon or whatever. And I can remember the true story. I come home one night from that meeting, and I'm talking to God, and I said, you know, I'd really love to have one of those women here at home with me, and blah, blah, blah. I said, you know, but you know, if I had a woman, I'd have to quit doing my meetings and quit doing this and quit doing that. And I said that just wouldn't be right. And I said, God, I said, if I had a woman, would just stay home and be there when I got home, and I could go and come and do what I wanted, it would be fine. And then I told God, I said, well, you can't have your cake and eat it too. So I told God, I said, I guess I'll just be single for the rest of my life. And you know what? God has a sense of humor, because 3 weeks later, he brought a woman into my life who's my wife today. So that commitment didn't last very long. You know, but you know, I have a good life today. And I'd like to share this. You know, when I said I've been in missions and Salvation Armies, I mean it, from Florida to Alabama to Texas, all over the country. And you know, they kick you out of those places 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, it's still dark, and you don't know where you're going or what's going on. And I can remember walking around the residential neighborhoods trying to find the newspaper I could see, find out where I'm at and what's going on, and what can I do for the rest of the day. And you know, today, I walk out from my own house, in my own driveway, and I pick up my own newspaper, and I look around, and I see all those other houses around, and I see this is mine today. You know, I have no idea how anybody's life can be if you're new. If you get in here and you just do what other people are doing, you know, my life changed so much, and there's no way I can express it. You know, when I was, before I got married, I'm thinking, I'm tired of San Francisco. I got the bug to move to Hawaii, and I got a newspaper, a Hawaiian newspaper, and I'm looking at how much it costs to rent, and I got a map so I can see where the different neighborhoods are, and I'm all ready to move. I figured out to the finish, I can just make it. Well, I couldn't have made it, but in my head I could. And, you know, so it didn't happen, and then, like I said, then I met my wife, and I got married, she already had a child, so I'm thinking, it'll never happen. You know, when I was going to those meetings up on Nob Hill where all those people were, they were talking about going to Hawaii to a convention there. And I was so envious. I thought, how? It never happened to me. You know? Well, it has. And I've been back there every year since I lived there, except for 1 year when I was in the hospital. So you never know what can happen. I even was there. I said to you, a lot of people don't care that much for Hawaii, but I do, and I even managed to live there for a year and a half, and so it's my surprise. So, you know, good things happen. All I had to do was to be willing to come in here and to do what you people are doing. You know, I've always been involved since I was 6 months sober in the rooms doing some kind of service work. When I first got sober, I was 6 months sober, and I used to go to this meeting in Poston Mason, and this guy came up to me and said, "We need a literature person." He said, "Well, I'd like to." First of all, he said, "How long have you been sober?" I said, 6 or 7 months. He said, "Would I be willing to do it?" And I said, "I don't know." And he misunderstood me. He went in and said I was willing to do it. Said I agreed to do it. And you know, I don't lie about the fear that I had. When he said that, I got a feeling inside of me that was kind of a fear. But you know, when I was walking home, I got a smile on my face. Because I remembered that when I was in AA before, and I was doing service work, I felt like I was a part of it. Like I belong. And you know, I am a part of Alcoholics Anonymous today. And you know, I come here not because I'm a great speaker, because you've seen how scared I am, but you know, because I have a story. And you know, it's a part, I'm a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to do whatever I can to try to give a little bit of hope to somebody else. Because you see, I didn't have any hope at all when I got here. I never ever thought I would be sober again. You know, I could never say enough to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, I tried to stay in service today. I tried to be a part of these rooms. And I'm thankful to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know what else to say other than the fact that I'm thankful that having the chance to come here and talk, and I hope I didn't bore you too much. Thank you.